The Guardian.
In the words of John F. Kennedy, leadership and learning are indispensable to each other. This is why the Guardian Public Leaders Network is an essential free resource for aspiring and practicing leaders, offering news, commentary, and best practice for everyone involved in politics and public services. Join today for free, and you could also win a Kindle e-reader. Visit guardian.co.uk/win-the-Kindle and start your free membership today.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir.
The eyes to the right, 400. The nose to the left, 175. So the eyes have it. The eyes have it.
Yes, a historic vote for equal marriage, but it splits the Conservatives. Who'll win in the battle of Tory mods versus rockers? Can David Cameron put his party back together again? Also this week, he lied and lied, and now he's gone.
The only proper course of action for me is now to resign my Eastleigh seat in Parliament, which I will do very shortly.
After Chris Huhne pleads guilty to perverting the course of justice, what will happen in Eastleigh, the seat he leaves behind? There will be blood, as they say. And we hear from the great and the good at the inaugural Political Book Awards. What makes a good political book? And who reads them? Joining me for all this, Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and the Reverend Giles Fraser. And completing the triumvirate, Max Wincowie from the think tank Demos. Welcome to all of you. The marriage same-sex couple bill passed its first major hurdle in the Commons this week with a comfortable majority. But the episode will leave open sores for the Conservative Party. 137 Tories voted against the bill, including two cabinet ministers. The debate lasted more than 6 hours, and there was a warning from MP Margot James of the internal battles to come.
Having been different for most of my life, Mr. Deputy Speaker, I can assure you that being treated equal is very welcome indeed, and we still have some way to go, not just in the area of gay people, but in other areas. And I believe my party should never flinch from the requirement that we must continue this progression. Otherwise, we may end ourselves up like the Republican Party, who lost an election last year that they could have won were it not for their socially conservative agenda.
Impassioned input too from the Tory MP Stuart Jackson. He was one of the many who opposed the bill, warning of a threat to religious freedom.
We're talking about a hierarchy of rights, that your rights are more important than my rights. And I think that is something that members that vote for this bill today should think very carefully about. Look at yourself in the mirror. Will you be responsible for a Catholic teaching assistant being hounded from her office as a result of this legislation? It is not fantasy. It can happen.
Well, last night I spoke to a couple of MPs who'd taken part in that long debate, the Conservative backbencher Douglas Carswell, but first, the Labour MP Chris Bryant.
I used to be a vicar in the Church of England. The old Book of Common Prayer had three reasons why marriage is a good thing. First of all, in their old terms, for procreation. Secondly, to prevent fornication and sin. And thirdly, for the mutual society that one gives to the other. Now, a lot of people in their marriage aren't going to have children. Prince Charles and Camilla, they're not going to have children now. I still think they should be allowed to get married because they're going to provide mutual support to one another. And exactly the same is true of gay and lesbian couples.
Given that there are very strong views on both sides, we look to the Commons to be able to find a way through it. Do you think the Commons was able to do that as one would expect it to?
There was a strong smell of martyrdom in the chamber yesterday, with a lot of Christians beating themselves up and saying, oh, it's terrible, I've said that I'm in favour, I'm opposed to gay marriage, and everybody's shouting at me. I tell you, my inbox on a weekly basis from people who hate the fact that I'm an MP and I'm gay, it would blanch your curtains. I'm not all that sympathetic to that.
Douglas Carswell, where do you think the party is, given the way the gay marriage vote went?
To be honest, I don't think people should read too much into it. It was a free vote. Some people voted one way, other people voted the other way. I was 51% one way, 49% the other. I had to jump one way rather than the other. It wasn't the best day I've ever had in Parliament. I'm glad the week's over.
Isn't it unnerving for the public, though, if they can't feel that the leader is at least in tune with his party?
No, I think if you ask most ordinary people around the country, they would see that there are two sides to the argument, and we want an authentic kind of politics and a party that recognises that it's a very complicated issue and they're two sides. They're good people on both sides of the argument. That's authentic.
Lots in the editorials this morning about this having been an unnecessary distraction. Do you share that view?
Yes and no. I mean, I was talking to a couple in my constituency who are in a civil partnership, and it's a pretty central issue to them. Of course, the economy is going to be more important to most people, but you know, in a political system, there should be room and time for both.
So does the Prime Minister just ignore what's happened in a way and just carry on as normal, as if he has the full the full control of his party?
Absolutely. Look, you know, I'm one of David Cameron's fiercest critics, and you know, I within the past few months, I've organised votes that have defeated his government. But, you know, for goodness sake, I'm just doing my job, and I'm pleased with the way he's doing his. You know, he needs to carry on, focus on the economy, and, you know, there'll be a few bumps along the way, but when MPs vote against him, they're just doing their job, and, you know, I personally think he's never been more secure.
So Carswell voted against, but says now we need to move on. So, Polly, an important vote, but will this be significant in terms of David Cameron's leadership of the party?
I think it's significant in terms of how people see the Tories, and that it's a serious defeat for him, and that he wanted, and quite rightly, to present the Tory party as something modern and new. And it has revealed itself as same old, same old. They, you know, they voted so overwhelmingly, either abstaining or voting against. I find it very surprising. And I think that it's quite damaging for him, and I think it's a shame.
Max, you've written in support of this bill, but you've also been uneasy about some of the way the debate's being conducted. I think last week in a passionate piece in Conservative Home, you said the gay rights lobby and its vociferous friends in the more militant ranks of Britain's secularists has demonstrated the very intolerance, demonisation and bigotry that gay people rightly decry when it's directed at us. Now, that was last year. Did the kind of quality of debate improve, do you think? And are you happy that you got to the right place in the right way?
The quality of debate on both sides of this argument has been appalling throughout. There are legitimate good reasons for people to object both to the principle of this bill and also to the technical details of this bill. I am broadly in favour of allowing gay people to marry. I'm a gay person who would like to get married. I don't think that that then buys me the right to dismiss everybody who might want to raise legitimate concerns about the impact of this bill as being bigoted, as being driven by hate. And I think that what has happened throughout this debate is that an unnecessary and really quite unpleasant level of hectoring has been evident on both sides, but I am particularly disappointed being on one side of this argument to have seen it coming from my side of that argument. And I think that the way in which ordinary Christian members of Parliament in particular have been attacked and have been personally demonised has been really very unpleasant.
But people feel so strongly about this. I mean, it was always bound to be a bit of a bare-knuckle fight, wasn't it?
I think it's quite extraordinary for anybody who has any working knowledge of the gay rights movement to claim that this, you know, gay marriage has been central to the agenda of gay liberation. I mean, 5 years ago, Peter Tatchell would tell you that he thought gay marriage would be a step backwards because it was about conformity rather than equality. So the idea that we can't accept as gay people that there might be legitimate nuances and arguments within this debate, I find absurd.
But what this has roused up is the obsession with sex. It's been really peculiar, and you're reminded all over again the depth of homophobia. I'd sort of forgotten. I thought this is going to be a sort of technical debate. Not a bit. Sort of emails I've had all about how, if we can't define what consummation is in technical legal detail for gay people, then we can't have marriage. And, you know, there's Charles Moore in the Daily Telegraph going on endlessly about the details of sex. What is fornication? What is adultery? What is consummation? It's been pretty disgusting.
Joss Roger, are you happy about where we've reached?
Do you know, I thought the debate in the House of Commons was a lot more civil than it's been in the Church of England over the last few years.
That so might well be.
Welcome to my world. I mean, I'm delighted. I mean, I'm delighted with the results. I think a lot of the Tories did show themselves to be completely out of touch. And I really find this invocation of sort of, you know, Christianity as being intrinsically hostile to gay marriage. For me, it's really, really galling because it's just a caricature. The idea that sort of Christian right, those two words go together. I mean, I'm passionately in favour of this. I think it's absolutely right, and I think it's right on Christian principles as well.
But on this, I mean, I'm a gay Anglican. I would like to be able to get married in an Anglican church. That's not a problem that the state can solve for me. That's a problem that the Anglican church has to sort out
for itself. I
understand that,
absolutely.
And in terms of the bill, I do think that there are legitimate concerns. I mean, Stuart Jackson was raising the question of the Catholic teaching assistant. There's been a lot of kind of hypotheticals, and I understand that it's easy to dismiss those questions as being...
It's fear-mongering. It's a lot of it. It's big fear-mongering. That hasn't happened on a whole range of other issues where people are out of step with the teaching of the Catholic Church. And it seems to me absolutely extraordinary that people can raise this level of anxiety. And it seems to me simply for a sort of political purposes, where there actually isn't that reality on any other subject out there.
It is the reality that people working in the public sector who have reasons of conscience to object to gay marriage, be they registrars, be they whatever, that they will be in a very difficult position over this. And that is the case. I mean, it's not fear-mongering to say
but if you're
that
serving
a Catholic
the public,
teacher...
If you're serving, I mean, I'm afraid the problem is some of us think it's analogous, not directly analogous, but it's sort of like not completely different to the situation over race. So if you said, I won't marry two black people, if you said that, you should rightly not be in the marrying business. So I think there is a point.
Let me bring Polly in here.
Max, I think you have a real problem because I don't see any longer how you can be both gay and in the Church of England. I mean, this law, and you want to get married. This law specifically prevents you getting married in the Church of England. I think you'd better become a Unitarian or a Quaker or one of those.
Polly, just like you
we'll wrestle with my soul afterwards. On the question of you raise a point here, which is that not only can this bill not solve the particular problem that I would like to be solved, but that it.
But why do you want to be in a church that hates you?
It doesn't hate me, Polly, and that's an objectionable thing to say about a church which has many different voices within it. This bill doesn't just not solve my problem. It doesn't actually solve anyone's problems. And that's my objection to it. It is bad law. And it was rushed through because David Cameron wanted to make the political points that you rightly say that he wanted to make about himself and his brand of conservatism. And in doing so, he brought a bad law before the House of Commons. One of the reasons why so many Conservative MPs voted against it is because they objected to being rushed into a situation where they weren't given the opportunity to try to influence the way in which the law was constructed to answer some of the legitimate problems that Stuart Jackson raises there. And I would say as well, in terms of Conservative MPs being out of touch, the Conservative Party in Parliament split roughly in the same way that the public do in opinion polls. The Conservative Party showed itself actually to be quite representative of what the public think about issues like gay marriage.
That's not true at all. All of the polls showed that the public were far more in favour than against.
Not all of the polls show that.
Well, you may find an obscure one, but if you took a poll of polls, it was quite obvious that the public were basically not only in favour, but also thought it was a non-issue.
Polly, what does this mean for David Cameron and his strategic leadership? What do we think of him after this?
Well, the Tory party is in a state of peculiar frenzy, and there he has been doing exactly what they wanted, finally giving them an in-out referendum. And in that very week, they explode into rifts about leadership. I mean, Ashcroft is the man with his hand on the polls and sees where people are, and the party is somewhere quite else. How very peculiar that the one good thing that the Tories have really got going for them is that their leader is more popular than they are. And if it's going to come to a leadership contest, Cameron versus Miliband, that's an ace for them. But for some reason, that's the one thing they're attacking. I find it very, very like how Labour felt in the 1980s, actually losing their marbles.
What will be the effect of this, do you think, Giles? Are good Guardian Liberals going to vote Tory now, do you think?
No. I think that's quite straightforward. I mean, I admire David Cameron for his leadership on this issue, and I thought there were a number of really good Tory speeches in favour as well. And I just think this is sort of like, you know, good moral common sense. But the idea that this might detoxify the Tory brand when the real issue, the bigger issue for many people, is actually things like benefit cuts and the way in which that impacts the poorest people in our society. I'm afraid no amount of good work on this issue is going to undo what is, for most people, a really a greater moral evil that's going on in the poorest parts of our society.
Max, you're happy now, but do you think this will get through the Lords?
I don't necessarily think it will, and I think it would be ridiculous and absurd for David Cameron to try to use the Parliament Act to force it through, considering it was a free vote in the House of Commons. So I actually don't necessarily think that this will become law. On the question of whether Guardian readers will vote for David Cameron, no. And the issue here is a central issue in the Conservative modernisation project, which is that David Cameron likes to be praised in Guardian leader columns, which should make the people in this room very happy. But that will never win him an election, because people who read Guardian leader columns are not going to vote for their Conservative candidate. So we need a new approach to modernisation, a new approach to engaging.
Just give up on us.
No, not give up on Guardian. You know, there are some things that it's right to do whether or not the Guardian endorses them. But nonetheless, that's not a strategy for winning an election. And that's not a strategy that's going to win new Conservative voters in the places where we don't have Conservative voters, in the north and in the inner cities.
We know there are a lot of middle ground people who are influenced by the atmosphere around a party, and they may not be going to be, I mean, nobody's going, I'd imagine, is going to be voting on the marriage issue itself. It's the aura around a party that really matters for swing voters. And if they look old-fashioned, out of date, out of touch with everything that's going on, that kind of tips over into lots of other policies too. They say, well, what do they know about life?
Which is why this was a strategic mistake, whatever you think about the principle. I mean, the pragmatics of this have been appalling. Not only did David Cameron kind of thrust it upon the party, he failed to take account of the fact that there was going to be lots of Tory MPs disagreeing with him very publicly, very vociferously. And he then did a very peculiar thing, which was to back off from it. I mean, I suspect the whips told him that if he wanted to get it through and he didn't want to lose any more Tory MPs in terms of supporting it, he should stop talking about it. But in stopping talking about it, he didn't even capture the political territory that might have been available to him from really taking the lead.
He's not trying to do new Tory, like new Labour, is he? I mean, this is the sort of, you know, the way Tony Blair would move it away from sort of red in tooth and claw socialism. So, you know, what Cameron is trying to do is new conservatism in that way.
But Tony Blair is not
going to work.
No, it's entirely a front issue, because the really important deep issues, Cameron is the most right-wing prime minister since the war. He's taken Margaret Thatcher and taken it much further, where she was, you know, privatising nationalised industries. He is privatising the state itself. His reforms, so-called, to welfare, cuts to welfare, the privatising of the NHS, these are things that have gone much further. But so this is a kind of lipstick on a pig issue. It's a kind of how do we make the Tory party look a bit nice? Lovely Steve Bell cartoon on that subject.
Well, with that thought, let's move on just a bit, because obviously we're looking at the wider significance and things do look a bit rocky at the moment. Today we hear of a U-turn by Michael Gove. He's dropped the idea of replacing GCSEs with an English baccalaureate certificate. That wheeze was announced just 6 months ago, the original idea. It was one of his flagship policies for schools. Labour say what we see is a humiliating climb down. The Tories say it's a policy tweak. What do we think of that, Polly?
Well, I think it's probably somewhere in between. I don't think it's a huge climb down, but it certainly isn't a tweak. What's interesting about this is that in the omni-shambles of this government, the one person who has been completely unshambolic and really very effective in following his own policies has been Michael Gove. And this is the first time that now he too has tripped over his own shoelaces. Once Ofqual came out and said, this system for new exams isn't going to work, he was done for, and he would have to retreat at least on that. It doesn't mean that he won't still be able to say, I'm really only going to count in league tables core subjects. It doesn't mean that he can't, within GCSEs, toughen them up a lot in terms of having less coursework. So we wait to see what the final plan is, but it does mean a large part of his idea of an English baccalaureate has gone, and he no longer looks like somebody who is a very strategic planner. He rushed at this back of the envelope, like so many of the other ministers have done, and has made a mess of it.
Max, did you look at the headlines and think, oh no, not again?
No, not at all. I mean, I think Michael Gove is a man who doesn't mind losing a battle to win a war. Polly rightly points out that much of the substance of what it is that Michael Gove wants to do to GCSE level qualifications, both the curriculum and how they're then examined, will remain. I think that in terms of the opposition that Michael Gove faces, I mean, in terms of the kind of entrenched establishment opposition, they're foolish to claim this as too great a victory. I mean, I support what Michael Gove is doing, but if I was advising those people who oppose it, I would say, you know, the devil is in the detail. And actually, Michael Gove has not conceded very much at all. He's conceded the certificate, right? That's it. The rest of it stays.
Giles, how's it look to you? Sleight of hand?
Well, I feel relieved, only in as much as I think the sort of poor people who work in education, who work in schools, who have been besieged year after year after year with changes in the way in which they work, and it's a constant churn of different acronyms, different ways of doing things, different strategies. I mean, these people live behind piles of paper, and the schools that I know, being a school governor in a whole lot of places, one of the most complicated things I've ever done. And part of that complexity is the fact that Westminster has, you know, making law itis on this subject. So anything that can just give them a little bit of peace and get on with their job, personally, I think that's all right.
Fat chance, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, that's probably right.
But, well, I mean, the best chance for leaving teachers alone to let them get on with pursuing their vocation and educating children is the broad thrust of Michael Gove's reforms, which are about liberating schools and school leaders to take more power and more responsibility and to innovate in how they teach children rather than being directed from Whitehall.
So the Whitehall directive will say these are the five subjects on which you're going to be tested, and any child who's doing arts, music, technology, business studies, things that really might engage quite a lot of children who otherwise might drop out of school are going to be cast aside because they won't be in the league table by which schools get assessed. And that is a tragedy.
Well, let's leave that for now, but there's plenty more commentary on guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, a year ago, he resigned from the Cabinet to fight his legal case. This week, former Lib Dem Deputy Leader Chris Huhne resigned his seat in Eastleigh after admitting that he arranged for his wife to take his speeding points a decade ago, thus perverting the course of justice. The betting is that he's going to jail. Polly, it's a personal tragedy for him, but does it have wider significance, do you think?
It is an awful personal tragedy. I particularly hate the way the media in this country and everybody else leaps upon any politician and loves their downfall. There is a particular sense of glee about destroying somebody's promising career of whatever party they come from. I always find distressing. And this has been particularly horrible. It's been a big public divorce, a lot of distress to the children. I think awful that you get children's emails read out in court, and I don't know why the judge didn't prevent that. So it's, you know, it's bad for politics and the way we treat politicians. You know, of course, if a politician does wrong, then he's going to lose his job and be punished for it. And that's as it should be. But I would like to see a bit less gloating. As for the importance of it, no, it's not terribly important. You know, he's been out of politics for a year now, effectively. What really matters, of course, is what happens in the by-election. Politics is cruel. It moves on very fast. Suddenly it's as if he'd never been, and Eastleigh is the big subject.
And we will get onto that. But Giles, do you think you're in the business of redemption? Do you have any sympathy for Christian? And is it right that we hold MPs to a higher standard?
I agree with Polly about the gloating and the schadenfreude that happens to people in public life. You know, I do think people in public life have a really, really tough job often. And we have this... I still don't really understand the why we have this sort of like massive anti politician thing in this country, and why we can't see people as doing public service and always thinking they're ripping us off and always thinking that they're lying to us. And so when they get caught, it's, ha-ha, I told you all along. And actually, you know, it's a terrible business, and it's a personal tragedy. And that's obviously what's going on here. Is there redemption? Of course, well, I mean, I obviously think there's redemption, there's secular redemption, and there's the brand that I preach as well. And, you know, that will take time to come, and wounds will take time to heal.
Max, let's talk about the by-election, the first in the Lib Dem seat since the coalition was formed. And it's going to be pretty tight, less than 4,000 majority for Huhne last time round. Can the Lib Dems survive?
I think they probably can, and I think actually that they probably will. I don't think that on the whole, when individual politicians fall and fail, that the public blames necessarily the party in particular. So, you know, Labour voters didn't blame Labour for Dennis McShane, and I'm not entirely certain that Lib Dem voters will blame the Liberal Democrats for Chris Huhne. Having said that, there's a particular set of circumstances. The Liberal Democrats, not the most popular political party in this country at the moment, but in Eastleigh in particular, you know, you're talking about a local area where in the last local elections, Liberal Democrats gained seats. They have an incredibly strong local party presence. And I think those who are kind of saying that if David Cameron doesn't win this by-election, it shows that he can't win anywhere, I mean, are talking nonsense. This is a Lib Dem stronghold.
Is this what you call, I've just seen, is this what you call a management of expectations? Is that what we're seeing here going on with you?
Well, no, I mean, I genuinely believe, I don't think that either in the Eastleigh by-election or when it comes to 2015, that the collapse in Liberal Democrat votes is going to be anywhere near what people are predicting. I think that there is a tendency in this country to take national opinion polls and read into them things that simply aren't there. You know, in Eastleigh in particular, you have a local Liberal Democratic Party that has, under Chris Huhne's very successful leadership, actually, in Eastleigh, built up a huge amount of public support. You know, in most areas of this country, Liberal Democrats were not gaining local authority seats during the last local elections. They were in Eastleigh, and the reason is that the party infrastructure there is incredibly strong. I hope that the Conservative Party wins, and I think there is a chance and a possibility that they can. I think that David Cameron does need to throw everything at it, but I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as easy as the lots of the punditry and lots of the political betting would tell you.
Polly, what about you, Kip? Nigel Farage contested this seat in the past in 1994, but he says he won't this time. And I can bring you an exclusive here. At the Political Book Awards last night, of which more later, the UKIPian Neil Hamilton was asked if he would run. And he said, probably not. I think there's only room for one arse in any constituency. So we won't be seeing him there. Marvellous what you hear when you sit directly behind Neil Hamilton. So it won't be him. But
that's a horrible thought.
Well, he might go back on that. That's happened before.
Well, he might do. That might be his election slogan. Polly, is this the kind of seat the Tories will worry about with regard to UKIP?
Well, it would have been, I think, if Farage had stood, but he's frit, and I think it'll do Farage quite a lot of harm, actually. You know, he had a chance, prime seat, absolutely the right, he stood there before, it's exactly where he should have stood, and everybody will say you're frit. It's a very peculiar by-election, this, because there are good reasons why no party should win, but somebody's got to win. And, you know, you think, well, the Lib Dems have fallen a long way, and Chris Huhne has probably done their reputation no good, they ought to lose it, but, you know, as Max has said, they're quite good at hanging on to seats they've got. On the other hand, the Tories certainly ought to lose it. They've fallen a long way since the last general election, so their vote should be down. Labour has no chance in that seat. Labour will be hoping that they increase their vote, but what will be interesting to see is whether Labour voters continue in seats like that to throw their votes to the Lib Dems or not, or whether they actually say, to hell with that, we're going to vote Labour, although we haven't got a hope in hell here. So it's very difficult to know which way they'll fall out. I think it's too close to call.
The Labour vote is the most interesting part of this, actually, and what the Labour Party decides to do in Eastleigh is really interesting, because it is a kind of win-win for Labour in a way. I mean, I don't think that anyone's going to punish Ed Miliband for not winning a Hampshire seat at this moment in time. However, the Labour Party could choose to throw a lot at this campaign in order to try and shore up, you know, we can win in southern areas with fairly affluent constituents. I suspect they won't, and I suspect one of the reasons they won't is that they spent a huge amount of money in Corby, which was a much must-win, and I suspect that the Labour Party will be very content to sit back and watch my party and the Liberal Democrats rip.
So you've
the
dampened the prospects
other.
For the Tories, and you've boosted the what Labour should be doing in the seat. I see a pattern here.
Well, I think you know, it's a mistake for the Labour Party to allow this contest to go on as a kind of Lib Dem Tory coalition bust up, because I do think that Ed Miliband needs to demonstrate that this is the kind of seat where he can not necessarily win, but improve the Labour Party's showing, and where he can take Lib Dem votes. But I suspect that they won't make much of an effort on it.
OK, let's move on. For in a heady week of frontline politics, there was also the glitz and glamour of the first Paddy Power and Total Politics Political Books of the Year Award. It's a mouthful in itself. The overall winner was Caroline Shenton's The Day Parliament Burned Down. But there were wins for The Guardian's own Ian Cobain and The Observer Sage and Politics Weekly regular Nick Cohen. But what makes a good political book, and who reads them? I asked some of the hopefuls and other dignitaries, starting with the BBC's political editor and shortlisted author, Nick Robinson.
It's got to pull the curtain back, hasn't it? It's got to say, welcome to the extraordinary drama of the world of politics. I mean, the success of Borgen on the telly or The West Wing is because it's about humanity with all its extremes, isn't it? It's about monstrous egos, the sheer theatre of votes about whether you'll get them or not. It's about the clash of ideologies and values. And a book has got to give you a feel for that, otherwise, frankly, it's going to be a bit of a dull read.
In one corner, champagne glass in one hand, is Geoffrey Robertson, QC.
Political books are essential to enable people to think behind the headlines that journalists like you write. I mean, politics is a matter of gossip, as you know very well and do very well. But what are the real issues behind the personalities?
I'm with Chris Mullin. Chris Mullin, what makes a good political book?
One that gives a flavour of the age in which it's written or about which it's written. Doesn't just say, tell you who said what to whom, but what it was like to actually be there.
Heather Brooke, what is the value of the political book?
Well, I think the books that were the best, they really had they drew a lot of things which you kind of didn't put together. The kind of overarching thesis that drew it all into one kind of overarching argument.
I'm here with Ian Dale, who's the originator of the event we're at tonight. The political book, is it in a good state? And if so, why?
Well, judging by the books that have been shortlisted for these awards, yes, political literature is in a good state. Unfortunately, political bookselling isn't in a particular good state because you've really only got one chain, Waterstones, now that are selling books. So if it wasn't for Amazon, I don't know where people would be buying their books. But there are some fantastic political books out at the moment. And I mean, next year, I've already sort of seen ones that I think probably ought to be on the shortlist for next year. So yeah, very healthy.
So many admirable books on show here tonight. But looking back, do you have a favourite political book?
I have. I'm embarrassed to tell you, I'm now going to forget its title. But I was once given a very slim volume, but about Mayor Daley in Chicago.
A good political book today, Jonathan Powell's book, The New Machiavelli. Very good.
My favourite ever political book is probably not really a political book at all. It's Chris Anderson's book, The Long Tail, ostensibly about how the internet's changing retail. But I read it and I suddenly thought, wow, technology is going to change everything, including politics.
Polly, as an author, do you have a favourite political book, one that's not got your name on the cover?
I'd just like to correct something that somebody said there. I think it was Ian Dale said, oh, well, if you can't, you know, the only place you can buy a book is Waterstones or Amazon. Actually, the Guardian bookshop is where you buy books from. If you don't want Amazon cheating the taxpayer, go to the Guardian bookshop.
Polly, that's marvellous. Put an extra £10 on your expense.
I'll tell you the book I've been reading that I really like this year, and I don't know if it was shortlisted or not. It's a lovely collation of political diaries called Events, Dear Boy, by somebody called Ruth Winston, who I don't know who she is, but it's a terrific book. I've got it, and I just flick through and pick out bits here and there. All the best bits of the diaries of everybody since the war, and it's a delight.
That was shortlisted last night at the Political Book Awards, and I can tell you who she is because she's the woman who helped Tony Benn compile his diaries. Because he got an award and he was very complimentary about her as well.
She really had her hand on the juiciest bits of a very wide range of political diaries. It's a pleasure.
Giles, do you have a favourite?
I do. Well, I hate the idea that politics is something that just goes on in Westminster. I just hate that idea that politics is something you have to have MP after your name and it's about gossip going on in the corridors of power and so forth. At the moment, because this is Orwell, you know, anniversary, I'm reading Down Out in Paris and London again, you know, very important. And it's very, very important politically. I mean, you know, just yesterday we found out that the homelessness in England over the last 2 years has risen 31%. So what more contemporary book can you be reading that something like than Down Out in Paris and London? Very important.
Max?
Well, my favourite political book of all time is a book called The Mayor of Castres Street, which is about Harvey Milk, which my mother gave me when I was a teenager and which made a big difference to me. But I'd like to nominate a book for next year's Political Book Awards, which is by the director of Demos, David Goodhart, which you can pre-order on Amazon now, which is called The British Dream and is a history of post-war immigration and multiculturalism, which I've had the honour to pre-read and which is a fantastic book.
Oh, I'm sure you've just got yourself a new contract for another year.
I think we don't contract people just for a year. We're a progressive organisation, Polly. I'm secure in my job.
There appears to be many agendas around this table, many people promoting things for their own gain. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to my guests Polly Toynbee, Max Wincowie and Giles Fraser. The producer of Politics Weekly was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thanks for listening.
In the words of John F. Kennedy, leadership and learning are indispensable to each other. This is why the Guardian Public Leaders Network is an essential free resource for aspiring and practicing leaders, offering news, commentary, and best practice for everyone involved in politics and public services. Join today for free, and you could also win a Kindle e-reader. Visit guardian.co.uk/winthekindle and start your free membership today.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.